Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We need to work out some arrangement quickly before the markets start to react and American families start to feel the consequences.
Well, it is summertime, but as Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid there knows, the living will not be easy for President Obama and members of both parties in Congress this month. If you haven't yet gotten your mind around the somewhat remote-sounding concept of the federal debt ceiling, it is time to start paying attention, folks, with an August 2nd deadline before the United States government would actually default on its debts. Can you imagine? The politics are roughly that congressional Republicans are trying to tie this short-term need to its long-term budget-cutting agenda and trying to push the Democrats into as many budget cuts and long-term limiting budget rules as possible while not raising any taxes. The Democrats and many centrist budget experts say you can't achieve a decade worth of debt reduction without revisiting some taxes on the rich or tax loopholes or tax deduction rules. You heard on that newscast one of the Democrat positions may be to try to limit a lot of the deductions that people get, like maybe for home mortgage interest or for having children, things like that, if you make over a certain amount. Medicare is at stake. Tax rates are at stake. More and more are all at stake right now as they play chicken with the debt ceiling. Here is some of the rhetoric around the issue from both sides in recent days, starting with Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell.
Our view is a good first step is a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. We think it's pretty clear, regardless of what we are ultimately able to negotiate here in the short term, that we put the federal government in this kind of fiscal straitjacket for the future so that we cannot get into this position again.
If we choose to keep those tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires, if we choose to keep a tax break for corporate jet owners, if we choose to keep tax breaks for oil and gas companies that are making hundreds of billions of dollars, then that means we've got to cut some kids off from getting a college scholarship.
Now, do we believe that tax reform is necessary? I would say absolutely. There's not enough time to get this done between now and August the 2nd, but it ought to be the first thing we turn to try to make our tax code more rational. We can bring down rates, eliminate the tax, a lot of tax expenditures or loopholes, and actually make our nation more competitive internationally.
Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas, preceded by President Obama, and Republican Senate Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. And to make it two and two, we heard at the top, remember, from Democratic Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. We'll get Jonathan Alter's take on this for today, the MSNBC contributor, author of a book on President Obama's first year in office and books on FDR and the Great Depression and more. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian.
Let us begin, assuming many people are just beginning to pay attention, by defining the debt ceiling. I know this is like, you know, we've been having this conversation for 6 months, but it sounds bad. We are trillions in debt already, and the government needs to borrow more by August 2nd. But what is this deadline really?
Well, what happened was in the past, this was a pro forma vote. It was totally non-controversial. When the government spends more money than it takes in for many, many years, the Congress has been consulted on raising the amount that we're allowed to borrow. But we've already spent this money, so to not raise the debt ceiling is the height of irresponsibility. And you have certain conservatives who are saying that we should just go ahead and not raise it and pay some interest and other essential payments and otherwise risk default, which just is insane. I mean, there's a kind of a flight from reason here and basic common sense that is truly alarming. Even if you purport to care a lot about the deficit, risking a default would be the absolute last thing you would want to do, because what will happen is international markets and domestic markets will crater, you know, within the next 3 weeks if we don't get this solved. And that will, in turn, you know, pull pull down the economy and worsen the deficit. The deficit always gets worse in a bad economy. So, you know, on many different levels, the inability of the Republicans, and they are, we might as well not mince words, Brian, they are the ones who are impeding a settlement. The inability of them to do the financially, fiscally responsible thing is almost breathtaking at this point.
So, listeners, we want you in this conversation. If you have a question about the debt ceiling and the debt ceiling politics, 212-433-WNYC. If you have a comment about the debt ceiling and the debt ceiling politics, what do you want in this? What do you want out of this? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Or our comments page is already buzzing at itsafreecountry.org, our politics website. Jonathan, you wrote on Friday in a Bloomberg News column that David Walker, former U.S. Controller General under presidents of both parties, is acting as a go-between in debt ceiling talks, and he is likening this to a ticking nuclear time bomb. Now, I don't think most Americans were that on the edge of their 4th of July barbecue seats, you know? So what I wonder is, yes, obviously, if America defaulted on its debts, it would be a calamity of unprecedented financial proportion. But is that just political hyperbole that comes with a high-stakes negotiation? And we all know that at the end of the day, all these people we heard in the clips, the president and Harry Reid and John Cornyn and Mitch McConnell and the others are going to sit down. They're going to get the best that they can for each of their sides and each of their ideologies. And we're just not going to default on our debts on August 2nd.
Here's the problem. We're in uncharted territory because, as I mentioned, this has been uncontroversial in the past when Congress has voted to raise the debt ceiling. We don't know how markets will react to this game of chicken. So this is not like a conventional Washington negotiation. This is a place we haven't been before, and we don't really know how it will go. And the other problem is that the parties really seem far apart at this point. So it's not like there are these clear grounds for settlement. I laid out what I think is, according to David Walker, the most reasonable areas of compromise. And he has talked to all of the figures in this negotiation, so he really knows what he's talking about. And that is, a series of short-term budget cuts, closing of some tax loopholes. The Republicans would have to give on that in the short term. But in terms of the big work to institute a series of triggers, fail-safe mechanisms, whatever you want to call them, that in 2013 would automatically create very draconian spending cuts and tax increases if these targets were not met. Now, that sounds a little bit abstract, but that's the way we balanced the budget in the 1990s through the Graham, Hollings, Rudman bill and the efforts of George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. They instituted these triggers and these caps, which had the effect of, bringing fiscal sanity to our country at a time when we had a pretty serious deficit.
By the way, the things that are in that David Walker compromise, as you say, sound kind of abstract. The things that we heard on the clips are things that Democrats on the one side, Republicans on the other side, can more get their fervor up for. So Obama comparing tax breaks for corporate jets and oil companies to needy college students who would otherwise not get their Pell Grants, or Mitch McConnell talking about wanting a vote on a balanced budget constitutional amendment as part of this deal. Not that it would pass. It would need two-thirds of the Senate, which I don't think it would ever get, and then it needs, three-fifths of the state legislature, so I guess that would be symbolic. But it's something that would benefit the Republicans politically. And then I gather the Republicans are insisting on a government spending to total GDP ratio, and this sounds abstract too, but stay with me for a minute, folks, a ratio of 18% of total government spending to the total economy or GDP as a rule going forward. And that can be a meaningless statistic. Or the Times editorial today says that would mean rolling government spending back to pre-Medicare and Medicaid levels. So I guess, you know, for Tea Party folks and some others, that could be an item of true faith. So these are the kinds of things that they're talking about publicly on either side. And then there are these more sort of middle-of-the-road compromises that I guess you're hoping that they all might accept.
Right. I don't think they're going to do major tax reform, major entitlement reform in the next 2 weeks. So they're going to paper it over in some fashion. And the question is, how? You mentioned earlier that, you know, centrist economists believe that there has to be some revenue increases to go with the spending cuts. It's not just centrists. Senator Tom Coburn, who is arguably the most conservative member of the United States Senate, Republican from Oklahoma, he was among those who has been outspoken in saying that there do need to be some revenue increases. You know, get rid of these ethanol subsidies. See, what's happened, Brian, is that getting rid of loopholes and corporate welfare is being perceived by the bulk of the Republican Party as a tax increase. That is the core of the problem right now, that most of these Republicans signed a pledge written by Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Reform that prevents them from voting for any tax increase. And Norquist defines a tax increase as the closing of loopholes, because that, in his mind, and he has a lot of power, is effectively a tax increase. So what has to happen in the next couple of weeks is you have to have some Republicans who are willing to buck Grover Norquist, who Alan Simpson of the Simpson-Bowles Commission last week described in Wyoming as the most powerful man in the United States, including the president.
All right, Jonathan Alter with us from MSNBC as we talk about the game of chicken that the U.S. government is playing with America's credit rating, with the debt ceiling deadline for August 2nd, and all this long and short-term budget wheeling and dealing taking place between the Democrats and the Republicans. And Michael in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Michael, thanks for calling.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for addressing this subject. I'm listening to Jonathan Alter, and I'm just amazed that this line of thinking coming from Timothy Geithner, Jonathan Alter, and others, that by not allowing this default, that by increasing the debt over and over and over is a good idea, and that people that don't want to see the debt ceiling increased are, as Mr. Alter just said, insane. I actually think the opposite is true. I think that people that want to continue piling on trillions and trillions of dollars of our national debt, those people are somewhat insane. And Mr. Alter talked about how if we allow this default to occur, there's going to be a collapse of the markets and that we're going to lose our standing in the world. That's going to happen if we have, what, $20 trillion in debt, $30 trillion in debt? I mean, when does this stop? Mr. Alter's attitude that we should just keep increasing the debt is what's gotten us to $14 trillion of debt in the first place, and it's going to continue until we're at, like I said, $20 trillion, $30 trillion. When is it okay to stop? I think the most responsible people out there are the ones who are saying, let's put a stop to this right now. Because the fact of the matter is, all this money that's being spent is not our money. It's our children's money. It's our grandchildren's money. All these debts are going to come and are going to have to be paid for by future generations, not by the current generation. So any effort to put an end to it right now and for us to pay our way as we go, I think is commendable. And I completely disagree with this characterization of again, the word insane, that people that don't want to increase the debt ceiling are insane. I think that's absolutely wrong.
Michael, thank you. And stay there for a minute, because I want Jonathan to respond to you and then for you to have another word. Jonathan, you know that the polls on this actually agree with Michael. I think it's something like 80 to 90% of Americans say no, don't raise the debt ceiling. Now that may be based on a misunderstanding of what this actually means. They may be saying, "Please don't keep borrowing money, U.S. government. We're already too much in debt." I think you're saying that this is a technical fix for money that's already been borrowed and needs to be paid back, or the U.S. goes into default.
Right.
But Is that your specific response to the caller?
Well, first of all, I generally like more restrained rhetoric, and so I don't want to call people clinically insane for differing on this point. So let me be clear about that. But I think the problem here is that there's this assumption that those who want to get past this August deadline somehow don't care about the deficit. That seems to be the subtext of the caller's point. And at least speaking for myself, you know, I am greatly concerned about the deficit, about putting it all on the credit card for our children. And I think anybody who takes a hard look at the budget knows that there have to be very deep cuts, including reform of entitlements, which is something that liberals don't like to face up to. These programs have to be mended. I don't think they need to be ended the way the Ryan plan does to Medicare, privatized, but they need to be significantly reformed, and all sorts of things like changing the retirement age need to be on the table. But having said that, for Americans who are not experts at international finance, as I am not, and not experts on what precipitates a default, not experts on the consequences of a default, to be blithely suggesting that we can just march into the maw of, you know, uncharted territory here.
As some Republicans, Michelle Bachmann perhaps, and others are, right?
Right. And remember, now, I'm not one of those people who thinks that experts are always right, because experts can be fallible. But when the Treasury Secretary and economists in both parties, people who study this for a living, almost unanimously say this would be a disaster, for us to blithely say, as the caller is, "Oh, it won't be a problem. We gotta bring a halt
get
to
our
spending
debt
right
control.
Now."
All right, Michael.
I think is rather uninformed.
Michael, did he convince you that the short-term debt ceiling is different from the long-term question of continuing to get into more debt?
No, he didn't. In fact, he just said that when the Treasury Secretary and others who have studied this issue say so and so. The fact of the matter is, these are the people that have helped create this $14 trillion.
Not true. Not really fair.
I'm not saying Mr. Geithner did it by himself, but I'm saying this kind of thinking, this kind of irresponsible and reckless behavior that saddles future generations with trillions of dollars in debt, money that, instead of our children and grandchildren being able to spend money on schools and roads and bridges and other things, they're going to be paying interest on the debt for expenses that we've made
today. I totally agree. But do you really think that your command of the technical details of what a default would constitute is sufficient for you to, you know, use this argument to say that
to have that much trust?
Do you really have that much faith in your own understanding?
Michael, we have another 20 seconds. Michael, we have 20 seconds for you.
I'll answer your question. I don't think that defaulting is anything less than a very, very serious matter, and it can have a very devastating impact. But I also think that $14 trillion in debt and increasing can have an equal or even greater impact on our long-term economic security. For those of you who are listening, you may want to think about the Suez Canal incident of the early 1950s, in which England, I think it was France, had to adjust their foreign policy because the U.S. held a lot of debt, and they were able to force them to adjust their foreign policy.
And in fact, Michael, forgive me, and thank you for your call. Please call us again, okay?
All right, thank you.
We're just out of time. But in fact, we're going to be talking to Henry Kissinger next hour, whose new book is all about China, about his theory that China is, paraphrasing here, and I hope I'm getting this right, going to be drafted into the position of strongest country in the world by virtue of the fact that it's the biggest creditor nation in the world, the position that the U.S. held after World War II. So, Jonathan, maybe a last thought on that to go out the door, and we have 30 seconds left. And obviously, folks, this is the first of, I shudder to think how many conversations on the debt limit we might have between now and August 2nd.
Well, I just hope that listeners, and I know that your very well-informed listeners are doing this, you know, familiarize themselves with some of the details of this to the extent to which we all have the details of the Dominic Strauss-Kahn case. You know, this is something that has not seized public attention and needs to, and we need to both get serious about the deficit and those who say they're not worried about it or living in a dreamland, but also recognize that it's silly and dangerous to play a game of chicken and to have an unnecessary crisis, which is what this is. We can be rational about this, put in a series of triggers to get everybody's attention over the next couple of years to reform the tax code and reform entitlements, and not have a crisis that is completely unnecessary at this point.
Well, we are going to talk next about the Manhattan DA's role in the DSK case and whether it was a bungle. But, Jonathan, we certainly take your point. And, by the way, folks, we led today with this much longer segment than we'll spend on DSK.
I'm interested in DSK, Brian. I don't want you to misunderstand
right.
me.
But if people know fewer of the details of what comprises the debt ceiling than they know of what was on the housekeeper's visa application, then our country is in trouble. So Jonathan Alter, author of The Promise, about the Obama administration, and MSNBC analyst, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And don't forget, listeners, every Tuesday, and that's today, our politics website, It's a Free Country, hosts an online politics chat. It's your chance to get together with other WNYC fans and It's a Free Country fans and talk about the big issues of the day. Today is a post-holiday anything goes political chat. You can talk about the emerging 2012 GOP field, the debt ceiling debate, how President Obama is gearing up for his reelection campaign. It's a Free Country's roster of columnists from left and right and center will be there to answer your questions and share their thoughts. This will be a text-based chat, so all you have to do is be near a computer or a phone to join in. Starts today at noon. Well, actually, a computer. I guess we don't have a mobile app for that. Starts today at noon at itsafreecountry.org. Join it. And when we come back, did the Manhattan DA blow the DSK case? We'll get two views.